Hello and welcome to The Affairs Current. My name is Carter Vance, your host. As always, if you want to contact us, feel free to on our email, theaffairscurrent@gmail.com, our blog, theaffairscurrent.blogspot.com, for all show notes and links and everything like that. So, after last week's interview with Miles, we're going to go back to our more traditional show format. And actually, we have a different guest than Edward this week. Who do we have on the other end of the line? Perhaps a familiar voice for longtime listeners.
Hi, it's Declan. I'm flattered to be replacing Edward.
Okay, perfect. And just for people who maybe haven't listened to the pilot episode that you were on, can you just sort of introduce yourself to the audience and tell them who you are and what you do, all that kind of thing?
So, young professional in Ottawa, sometimes writer for The Westerner, currently a public servant, and, just generally a cynical leftist is how I would classify myself.
Okay, perfect. So what we're going to talk about today is the Democratic primary in the United States, but with a particular view towards the sort of reaction that Bernie Sanders' rise in the polls has been generating. And then secondly, we're going to talk about kind of a broad overview with a particular focus on Uber, but I think we can go a little bit deeper than that, about the sort of sharing economy or these sort of technologically innovative services, what we think the left progressive response to them should be. But first, we're going to talk about Bernie Sanders and the Democratic primary. So, of course, as we record this, tomorrow is going to be the day of the Iowa caucuses, the first big sort of electoral test for both the Democratic and Republican potential nominees for the presidential contest in the United States. Now, of course, as many people have pointed out, the Iowa caucuses are kind of a bad way of testing your actual electoral strength because Iowa is not a very representative state. The caucuses are a very strange form of primary. It's kind of considered, I've heard the term beauty pageant bandied around for it. But nevertheless, it is, considered the first test. It's really the first chance to, not opinion polling, an actual kind of definitive statement about the support that these candidates can muster. Now, the reason I guess I'm particularly interested in talking about this is because Bernie Sanders has really, gone quite far ahead in the polls. Of course, Bernie Sanders, famously the independent, self-described Democratic Socialist Senator from Vermont, is challenging, Hillary Clinton, establishment, candidate. I think everybody knows who Hillary Clinton is, for the Democratic Party nomination. For a long while, he was kind of down in the polls. It didn't really seem like he would have much of an impact. Seemed like he was sort of impacting the debate by making Clinton take slightly more left-wing positions than she otherwise would, but that was going to be his impact, limited to that. But, in really just in the past few weeks, his poll numbers have just skyrocketed, and now he's in some of the polls I've seen about ahead of her by about 20 points in both Iowa and New Hampshire. So, of course, this has now led to kind of an inevitable reaction on the part of both Clinton, the media, more broadly the Democratic establishment, who don't really like Sanders for a variety of reasons. He's not technically a registered Democrat, for one. For another thing, he has policy positions which, while moderate by, sort of European social democratic standards, are considered quite out there for the mainstream American discourse. So I guess the first question is, in your opinion as an observer of this, and I know you've written, in fact, and perhaps we can link to it, an article for The Westerner about Bernie Sanders, but as a longtime sort of observer of the man and his politics, what do you think is the reason why he's doing so well now?
Well, I mean, it's he's finally catching up on sort of the social welfare reforms of Europe itself. He appeals to a broad base of people. Some people want to marginalize and pigeonhole his appeal to, left-wing white males, but demographic analysis of his coalition of supporters has shown it to be a lot more broad than people who are trying to, or the establishment is trying to narrow him into. I mean, I think he's a hope and optimism candidate that Hillary Clinton can just never muster not sort of in the same way as Obama did it, because Obama was a very different candidate, but He combines a sort of outsider image, even though he's been in politics for upwards of since 1981. I think he was the mayor of Burlington. 1991, he was the congressman. 2007, he was elected the senator, all of Vermont, or Burlington, and then when he was in Congress and Senate for Vermont. So he's been a long-time political insider, so to speak, but he's always been as an independent on the outside. And I think 2016, just as 2015 was before, will be the year of the outsider candidate, as well as kind of economic justice resonates. Post-recession, post-2008, it still doesn't feel cleared up. That sort of uncertainty in the marketplace is still omnipresent. So I think a mix of populism, hope, economic justice, they all sort of resonate as well. Hillary has never been able to get the coronation that she's expected.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's what a lot of people have been comparing this to, the, unexpected. And people should, let's wind the clock back a bit. It was very unexpected that Obama won the Democratic primary in 2008. He was, first-term senator, who, let's be frank, doesn't have necessarily the kind of background you would expect somebody who becomes the president to have. And he was going up against Hillary Clinton, who was the presumptive frontrunner. But he was really able to harness this coalition of people who really believed in that hope and change message. Now, I think the difference with Sanders, well, a number of things. The first thing is that while Obama had this sort of hope change kind of message, it was deliberately very vague about this. And I've heard the term lyrical technocracy used to describe Obama's policies, which is to say, even when in the primary, when he was talking about these things, it's actually just not substantively true. People will make the argument that, oh, candidate Obama said this and, President Obama did this. But on most issues, there are a few specific things around national security and privacy rights and things like that where you can definitively say he switched. But actually, he was always basically a kind of moderate, center-left sort of Democrat, a normal Democrat, maybe slightly to the left of where they were under the Clinton, Bill Clinton, I should say, era. But nevertheless, whereas Sanders has a very definitive ideological position, even though he is now moving into this more kind of hopeful message. His slogan now is, I think, a future to believe in or something like that. For a long time, his whole shtick, and I don't mean that necessarily disparaging way, but his whole thing was just frankly being this very angry Jewish guy from Brooklyn. He has a, a very thick accent, that very kind of almost stereotypical kind of thing that he has been able to work, and just about, outrage at, as you put it, economic injustice. And this manifests itself in a number of different ways, and I think one of the ways it manifests itself that may be a negative for Bernie Sanders, and it kind of goes back to something you were saying, I think it's a little more complex than people will make it out to be, is the fact that he, when he goes outside of that narrow lane, whether it's foreign policy, where he's often a kind of jumbled mess, during a debate, he praised the King of Jordan for some strange reason. He doesn't really appear to have any particular foreign policy like viewpoint. He's less hawkish than Clinton is, but Clinton is a pretty hawkish Democrat. So that's one problem. The other thing is that while he has been, active, and I would say, policy-wise, basically definitively, he is, much better on issues of civil rights and racial justice and things like that, than particularly Clinton, who, I mean, there's a long record of her under Bill Clinton's administration, with, criminal justice issues, certain rhetoric she used surrounding, people who received welfare during that time, etc. But the thing is, what it manifests itself in the case of Sanders is that he views everything through this sort of economic lens. And I'm not, he's not a, and I want to be, I'm going to use these terms very carefully. He's not a Marxist, but I think he views the world in fundamentally Marxian terms, which is to say, everything is ultimately a sort of contest between rich capital and labor, or like, as he would put it, the 1% and the rest of us.
Class issues definitely define most of his the way he views it. It's very materialistic and
Exactly. He's very, and that's exactly the right word, is he's very materialist, which means that when it comes to these let's say, postmodern kind of things, because he views it in that sort of way, he comes off as a bit tone deaf, and not really understanding, like, what the issue is. Like, there, and a lot of it is these things which I understand may strike some people as like, well, what is the big deal about that? But there's even things like the fact that he doesn't ever use, like, saying he or she in a speech, like that phrasing, he or she. He just uses he, like, and I don't think he sees anything particularly wrong or sexist about that, but it's just to say that he's very much a 1930s leftist and not a 1960s leftist. He hasn't kind of keyed it, but, and I think just to say all that, I think that may be limiting his appeal. Now, I will say this. I think that narrative, which has really been clung on to in this very kind of interesting way by the Clinton campaign, I think is in a lot of ways, at the very least, overblown. If you look at the actual polling numbers, women under 45 actually greatly prefer Sanders to Clinton. Over 45, it gets Clinton is higher. But just to say all of that, I think what has been a very interesting trend that has occurred in both the case of Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn has been this bizarre sort of embrace of these postmodern political identities as a way of attacking somebody who, you know, yes, in both cases are both Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders, you know, old white guys, absolutely. But if you look at their actual policy, you know, frameworks, I think they would be considered more progressive than a centrist candidate. But the interesting thing is the way in which these kinds of issues have been used as a sort of rhetorical way of attacking them. And I guess I don't know what you think that speaks to.
Well, I mean, I think it speaks to the establishment kind of being worried. I mean, there's a lot to work on from what you said. It is kind of funny. It is kind of a strange bedfellows of these 1930s leftists who have been talking about and using democratic socialism as a framework for understanding the world and then empowering the public policy principles that they would like to put forward in the polity of these Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders, these 70-year-old white men who have been through politics for decades, trying to make peace with this rise of youth, this youth movement of identity-based politics. It's a strange blend, and I think that speaks to the tone-deaf nature of what you were saying earlier. And I think that the establishment being a little more basically seizing on any opportunity to sort of stick the knife in the back, are seizing upon that.
And I mean, I think the interesting thing you say there is that the actual divide, I mean, both the young voters in both the case of Corbyn and in the case of Sanders, the young people are actually their base, which is kind of funny when you think about it, that like all these young people are like really hyper enthusiastic about these like 70-year-olds. But I think it's interesting, like you're saying, I would agree with you that I think what this is just they're trying to find any sort of pot or pan they can find in the kitchen to hurl at these people. So yeah, that works, saying, you know, there's been these sort of bizarre things that have come out with the Clinton campaign about like trying to do this like weird logical analysis of like, well, like if you actually implemented Bernie Sanders' healthcare plan, it would mean that like all these people would lose their health care, man, because, like, we've worked out this whole – or even, like – I think the sort of apex of this was – and I don't want to get into really the substance of the question because I think it deserves its own podcast. It deserves its own series of podcasts. But, an interviewer asked Bernie Sanders a very direct question about the idea of reparations for slavery. I believe they specifically said for slavery in the context of America. And he said, no, I would not support that. I think it would be very divisive, etc. Like the normal sort of response. Now, then Ta-Nehisi Coates, who of course wrote a very, I think, convincing and lengthy case for reparations, you know, responded saying, you know, this shows that Sanders is not really as radical. It shows that there's limits to the interpretation of radical politics in the American context. But just to say that the very interesting thing I found was that, you know, regardless of what your opinion on the moral justice of reparations is. It's very interesting because, you know, both Sanders and Clinton have the same substantive policy position. Okay. Then a Clinton advisor went on CNN and basically said, you know, well, you know, Bernie Sanders isn't sensitive to the issues that are facing, da 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 da. And you can tell from his very dismissive response about reparations that he just doesn't. And, like, and this is a very interesting thing. Now, I think it's actually, you know, encouraging that now in the Democratic primary, people are being asked very direct questions about, you know, reparations, about those sorts of issues. I think that's actually great. But it's very confusing when somebody who has, you know, whose candidate has the same policy position, and, you know, in fact, does not even frame things in such a way. I mean, I think if you ask Sanders and people kind of asked him to elaborate, his whole thing is, well, you know, black people are disproportionately poor. If we empower, you know, more poor people through these universal programs, that will do the job for us kind of thing. Now, you can, that's a whole other debate whether that works or not. But just to say that it's very instructive that that's the angle they chose to go at it with, because the one place where there is a definitive break between Clinton and Sanders is black and Latino voters who, for whatever reason, whether it's a lack of recognition, whether it's a lack of, you know, whether it is this sort of tone deafness, like I mentioned, or whatever it may be, do back Clinton more than they back Sanders. Now, that may change as Sanders gets more of his message out there. And in fact, you know, he has actually received recently some endorsements from some prominent African Americans, Cornel West, Michelle Alexander, Killer Mike, doing post-debate, shout out to Killer Mike, doing post-debate spin room for him. But just to say that, so I think that may be the one place in this whole discourse where there is actually a really scientific polling data that you can latch onto that would confirm that narrative. But anyway, so sorry, go ahead.
Oh yeah, I was just going to speak on, I mean, Bernie Sanders doesn't have very good, outside of Iowa and New Hampshire, he doesn't have great name recognition. As for the Clinton advisor, oh, I believe his recognition is about 15% outside of the primary states amongst general population, which is still, I don't know how it's that low, but it's still quite low. As for the Clinton advisor bashing Bernie for the same policy that Clinton does, I think that's just attacking the enthusiasm, right? Just trying to slow the momentum. It doesn't even matter. People aren't even going to check Hillary's stance on it. And I think there will be some crossover, regardless of his stance on reparations. I think as more African-American leaders, I would say, and activists kind of see Bernie's message of economic justice, and it'll still address some of their concerns. While it's not a specific and specialized sort of apology and reconciliation for the crimes and sins that have been committed by, you know, white American forefathers, it's still something that will help directly African-American communities.
Well, I mean, I think in specifically Michelle Alexander's case, who, for people who don't know, Michelle Alexander wrote this book called The New Jim Crow, which is it's a very good book. You should read it. But it's very much about the impact of criminal justice system on particularly African-Americans. She touches on Latinos a bit in there as well. But just to say, her whole argument, which is a very policy-based argument, was, look, the Bill Clinton administration with the 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill is, like, heavily responsible for, you know, this massive over-incarceration of the African-American population. Why in the world would I support, you know, Hillary Clinton, who supported that policy? I'm going to support Bernie Sanders if for no other reason than he, when he was in Congress at that time, opposed that legislation. So, you know, and that was her whole argument, was basically that, you know, you have to really look at the records. And I think that ultimately really should be what it is, what it should come down to. But I think, as you pointed out, part of it may just be, you know, a lack of name recognition, because I think the thing is with Sanders, he may, you know, the resources might not be there. And I think what he is trying to do, at least at this point, is get those victories in Iowa and New Hampshire, and then from there be able to build further from that. Because if he wins Iowa or New Hampshire, or he wins both, which he's on track to do right now, that automatically gets you news coverage. And actually, there's been analysis that's shown that he's systemically undercovered by most media in the United States. So, I mean, you know, draw from that whatever conclusion you want. But just to say, I think that's kind of his strategy, is win these states, that'll get me more recognition, then people in South Carolina, wherever, will start to notice me, think about my message more, think about how I can help their communities more. And I think that's what he's betting on.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. Just going back, I think there's an interesting feminist question about, you know, how much the wife of a political figure, she's really to blame for... you know, the decisions made by her husband.
I
mean, not that she's blamed. I mean, she was a very active first lady that, you know, defended the position.
Yeah, that was, that it way. Wasn't, yeah, I mean, just to back up, like, I don't think I or Michelle Alexander was saying that, you know, she's responsible for this because Bill Clinton passed it.
Mm-hmm.
It was more that she went on TV and, you know, actively lobbied in favor of that bill, and in fact said things about, like, quote, super predators and all this kind of stuff, which really reinforced these kind of racial narratives that led to public support for that kind of policy, which was so was and continues to be so devastating to the black community in America.
Yeah, as well as, you know, reinforcing those racial stereotypes that are just not even from a policy perspective, just as a from a thought dimension of the public consciousness. It's sickening. But going towards the more electoral thing for Bernie, yeah. He has a pretty robust fundraising network, though, of grassroots donors. I mean, his average donation is only $29. He has, you know, I think upwards of 1 million donors. I don't know the number on the top of my head, but it's an impressive, and I actually watched this MSNBC interview with him, Morning Joe, and I was shocked because I was expecting them to be much more dismissive, but instead they were kind of praising the sort of grassroots fundraising network that he's been able to set up and has actually trumped a lot of Obama's records for his, you know, very famous grassroots fundraising activities. And it kind of, it's reminiscent of almost like a Citizens for Ike, the Eisenhower alternative grassroots network that was set up in 1952, I believe, as a response to not being very well entrenched in the Republican machine. He kind of set up this alternate fundraising and activist, you know, infrastructure for to push forward this his presidential campaign, which I think is you're kind of seeing the same thing with Bernie, and that Bernie is working in this sort of new infrastructure for his own presidential campaign and grassroots fundraising most of it. And once he wins Iowa and New Hampshire, yeah, the coverage will follow. And I think the final hurdle of the electability argument will really be put to bed. I mean, I think that's the nail in the coffin for it. I mean, there's been quite a few left-wing, more liberal outsider candidates, like, I mean, I guess I would put in maybe Jesse Jackson in the 80s, maybe Howard Dean, I believe, in 2004, these sort of left-wing outsider figures that try and push not just push the party left, but also to win the leadership contest. I think he's one of the only ones that I think can think of that has been this close to, you know, really pulling it around. I mean, he's going to trounce, if he's on track for the polling, he's going to trounce Clinton in both his two primary states, and it's more than a black eye to her presidential ambitions.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the thing is that, you know, as you put it with the comparison to Obama, I think the other thing you have to really keep in mind there is, you know, even when Obama was getting a large amount of grassroots donation and large amount of sort of ground level enthusiasm, he was also taking a lot of money from, you know, Wall Street. He was also taking a lot of money from these various lobbying companies. Now, part of that may have just been like they sort of saw the writing on the wall and with what was going to happen in that election. So they said, well, we may as well get in good with whoever comes in. And I should point out that, like, that was true in 2008. That was not true in 2012. So, I mean, you know, there was probably just a degree of, like, we know we're going to get hit by some kind of financial regulation. We may as well try to throw some money at them to soften the blow kind of thing. But nevertheless, I think, you know, as I sort of said before, I think what definitively changes that sort of argument is this idea that there is, and actually quite different from even though I like your comparison to Dwight Eisenhower there, what also makes it different is that, you know, Eisenhower is running as a fundamentally and governed as a fundamentally centrist president, right? And the reason people wanted to recruit him was because of his reputation from World War II, whereas you know, people seem to really be buying into the proposal that Sanders is making. Now, is it here's the other thing. Is it realistic? Now, here's what the argument that the Clinton people would make to you is like, look, because of, you know, electoral gerrymandering, because of demographics, because of all these things, politics for the foreseeable future in America is just going to be like basically ideological trench warfare with the Republicans. And Sanders' pitch basically is the idea of there's all these non-voters who are not engaged with the process. We need to have this, you know, the term he uses is political revolution, to bring those people in and definitively change the system so that more people can be involved. And he sort of, oddly enough, in a quite similar way to somebody on the Republican side, is basically making the argument that, like, look, there's all these people who aren't engaged with the process, who have, you know, common sense ideas like I do, and the only reason they're being shut out is because of money, because of influence, because of all these channels. We need to bring them in, and then we can win on that platform. Now, that's a very interesting idea. I just don't know if that's ever worked, really, because the thing is that I think a lot of people, I mean, people make all these sort of weird assumptions about, like, who, quote, non-voters are. Now, I don't know if there's been, like, really definitive study about, like, why people don't vote in the current situation, because, I mean, I do agree that, like, some of them are probably just feel quite alienated, don't feel like anyone is standing up for them. But then I would also imagine that at least there's a percentage of people who are just very apolitical, don't really care about politics. There's probably another group of people who just think, you know, things are just fine. I don't really need to be engaged with this. There's probably a lot of other people who are just completely turned off by politics for not ideological reasons, but more aesthetic reasons. So I guess that if I was going to make a critique of Sanders, I would say that his analysis of, you know, what is going on politically wise in America may be true, but I think it overestimates the number of people that he could engage with his message. But I may be wrong about that, and I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, the non-voter is kind of an elusive beast. We're told all sorts of things about what they are and what they think. And I think breaking it down makes a lot of sense into, you know, there are apolitical people. There are people who are never going to be engaged. There might be people who are, you know, disenfranchised to a degree because of their lower class standing or time, or, you know, there are plenty of barriers to participation, although the bar is still pretty low in terms of voting. I think growing the electorate is a strategy that's definitely tried to be. There's this sort of narrative about left-wing candidacies that higher turnout affects them and, you know, increases their chance of winning. I've never really understood the core fundamental assumptions of that narrative, but it's an interesting one. And especially, I think, for Sanders specifically, he's trying to draw on, through an economic justice message, and I shouldn't say he's trying to draw on, because he's always been drawing on this message, a lower class, the lower class that does not vote. Because there is if there's not a caricature of a non-voter, there is a caricature of a voter, and they're generally, you know, more affluent, you know, more connected, you know, not minorities, I would have to say, as well.
They're and I mean, I think just to maybe expand on that a little bit, the whole idea of, like, expanding who the electorate is benefits left-wing parties fundamentally comes from a lot of historical examples in Europe where, you know, I mean, when you had just very restricted franchises through poverty franchise or whatever, yeah, you tended to get results that, like, favored elite interests for obvious reasons, right? So, when you expand the electorate, you're usually expanding into people who have lower incomes, who have, you know, different sort of sociological backgrounds, which lead them to favor left-wing policies. Now, that's historically true in Europe. I don't know how true that is in America, because the interesting thing that I've seen as far as the polling analysis goes is that, okay, so let's talk about a little bit about the other side of the political ledger right now. So, you have Donald Trump on the Republican side. Now, the interesting thing is both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump bring in a certain demographic of people who heretofore have not really been engaged with the political process. The thing is that they bring in two different demographics. In the case of Trump, he brings in sort of, I'm going to use the term downwardly mobile white people, if that makes any sense. So basically, So basically, you know, white middle or working, lower middle or working class people who, look, I don't really want to get into to why they, you know, what level of it is economic, what level of it is racial. It would really vary on the individual person. But certainly they feel like things have not been going their way in America for a variety of reasons, some of which may be legitimate, may be illegitimate. And they go to Trump because of that. The thing, and they're older as well. That's the other thing I should point out. Kasich Sanders, he brings in people who are younger, who are more likely to have a higher education, all that kind of thing, who also feel alienated from the political process for some of the same reasons that the Trump people feel alienated. They feel like there's too much money in politics. They feel like there's too many elite networks that they can't access. They feel like, you know, they have student debt, they can't get on the housing ladder, all that kind of thing. So in a lot of ways, they share similar concerns, but the demographics are different. So I guess what I'm trying to say here is that I think in both cases, you are talking about expanding the electorate. The question is who you're expanding the electorate to include, and then what kind of policies they would respond to. Because I think there was a very interesting article, I think in the New York Times, that was talking about people who literally, like, they were able to find some people, though I don't know how representative they were, but it was very interesting to see what they said, who said, I'm either going to vote for Trump, or I'm going to vote for Sanders. Those are the only two people I like. And it was very interesting that what they said was basically this idea about, you know, all these elites run everything, you know, who's the person looking out for the guy like me? And I think what this ultimately kind of comes back to, which is something that I think we've been touching on in many episodes of this podcast in many different ways, is the decline of the legitimacy of institutions as relates to the populace in the Western world. I think both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump fundamentally represent an electorate or a section of the electorate who is very tired of hearing that somebody knows what's best for them, that, you know, things are under control by the elites, things are under control by these institutions. I think they have sort of said, rightly or wrongly, that, you know, this is all a lie, we need to blow the system up. And whether that's, you know, and again, that manifests itself in all kinds of different ways. Trump, the Front National in France, Jeremy Corbyn, Podemos, Syriza, the list goes on. I think there's a real feeling that these politicians are capitalizing on. And I think it could go in many, many different ways.
Yeah, I think you're right when you say they both speak to alienated groups. Well, I shouldn't say groups, I should say alienated individuals of people that have given up on the legitimacy of the system, as well as when you have, you know, the media-driven narrative of almost constant crumbling of the world, as well as these politicians trying to keep a cap on it. It's kind of a powder keg in terms of individual emotion about how the world is actually performing. And I think in America especially, you have a very large gap of how the world is really performing and the perceptions of the world. I think that's why the populist is so, you know, or is doing so well now, because, you know, you can play off those perceptions of doom and gloom to magnify your campaign. Yeah, I also kind of, going back to the growing the electorate, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn did it for this UK Labour Party leadership contest, and it worked surprisingly well, drew in hundreds of thousands. Subsequent analysis, though, has shown it wasn't quite the lower class that frequently is trumpeted by, or I shouldn't say trumpeted because that sounds too Trump-esque, but heralded by left-wing parties. It was very much still a middle-class professional block of people that were drawn in, very London-centric, that were drawn in by Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that demographic is similar in a lot of ways to the demographic that Bernie Sanders brings in. And again, to go back to the UK, that working class, lower class electorate, whatever you want to call them, in the UK, they are going to UKIP, actually. So UKIP is kind of like Trump. So I think this is a very interesting thing, is that, you know, fundamentally, the formation of left-wing political parties, this is less true in America than it is in Europe, was always based on trade unions, right? That was what they came out of, who fundamentally, you know, trade unions represent working people, working class people. The thing is, you know, because of the decline of trade unions for a variety of reasons, that kind of no longer holds. So what the base of the parties became in England anyway, the base of Labour was more you know, people who have particular ideological convictions, but tend to be middle class, or at least lower middle class. Like, they're not working class, they wouldn't be represented by a trade union, they tend to be a bit more professionals. So, and I mean, I think the same thing might be emerging in America, although to a lesser degree because of the way the party systems are set up, etc. So I think this is an interesting thing about, like, where left-wing politics is going, is if you kind of, if your base starts going to these, let's say, populists of the right, what's your fundamental legitimacy based on in the future? So that's a very interesting question, although I feel like we're running a little bit long on this segment. So I guess you want to kind of sum up what you think Bernie Sanders's chances are in the forthcoming election, and also if you want to kind of sum up why you think there has been this backlash from the establishment towards him.
Just going quickly over what you said about the UK, is I think it is a mix of economic leftism and social conservatism that was a bedrock of, you know, left-wing parties for so long, but it's a cross-cleavage around cosmopolitanism and social conservatism that really creates this defragmentation of all the party, the electoral coalition. Going to the Bernie Sanders, as an unabashed Bernie bro, I think he has 100% chance of becoming president, not just becoming the Democratic nominee. I mean, if you pair him up with someone like Trump, I think that's a viable contest as well. You pair him up with someone like Jeb Bush, maybe, or a Rubio. I'm a little, the youthfulness of Rubio might be a bit disarming, and as well, Jeb Bush is a little more reasonable, I guess, if you want to put that in quotation marks, in context of the Overton window, or the perceived Overton window of the political, U.S. political culture. If you put him up against Ted Cruz, I can't imagine Ted Cruz and his evangelical base prevailing in mainstream America, but that's just me. But if the question of whether he can get there, if he can make his way through the Democratic establishment, that's a real question, because it definitely feels that in previous contests, you know, it's all within the family, but with Sanders, it's not quite all within the family. It's very much a more ruthless game, as he has been an independent most of his political life. He certainly caucuses with the Democrats. He's, you know, sided with them on committees and such, but he's very much not quite the party man. So the establishment, from, you know, Democratic blogs to the media to just the chair, even the DNC has been, you know, there's a perception of the DNC clearly favoring Clinton, you know, making sure the debates are on days that are poorly televised so that, you know, Sanders has problems getting name recognition. The Sanders breach, in which his campaign was actually suspended for, I believe, 2 days. And a letter was sent out to every single Democratic member basically saying there was a data breach and Sanders' campaign is to blame for data mining the Hillary campaign when this breach, or the breach happened, although it was the fault of the data company that maintains the DNC master list that allowed Bernie Sanders' campaign to get access. So there is a question of, you know, how hard are they going to block Bernie? Always going back to the UK, I'm sure a general is not going to, you know, put forward the idea of a mutiny if Bernie Sanders becomes the Democratic nominee. But I think he could definitely defeat Hillary. You know, if he's shown his way around these two caucuses to be pretty exceptional, I don't see why the other, I mean, of course, these two states, New Hampshire and Iowa, are not representative of the overall population. But and even the establishment itself has given up the unelectability argument. I think they've moved to this second order critique by brandishing his proposals as sort of pie in the sky idealism. You see that in the healthcare policy debate. You know, he just gets smashed for his single payer system, which, you know, has been sort of the dream of liberals much, much further right than him, of, you know, since the 1930s. I mean, the first sort of idea of around socialized medicine comes up in the 1930s, and we see the healthcare lobby show up as well at a similar time. We see it again in the four freedoms of Roosevelt, the freedom from want. Roosevelt had, you know, a healthcare policy that was kind of pushed back, and he put it off because, you know, the resistance to it. We see it again, it comes up in the Fair Deal with Truman. There's a socialized medicine aspect to it, that now in that proposal, or that vision. And you see it for, you know, even in the 90s, Bill Clinton had a healthcare plan that was to reform healthcare. again, shelved because of opposition, because of lack of political capital and courage. So it's nice to see that he's sticking to his guns by putting forward single payer, nothing but single payer. Whereas Obama even went, you know, he waffled, you know, people thought he might put single payer out there. He waffled and returned to this sort of, it was certainly a good reform, insured a lot of people, but it wasn't quite sort of the dream that liberals have had across the world, where in Europe they've already achieved this much long, a much longer standing achievement, where they've already had single payer for public options for decades. But America, the U.S. political culture just can't quite get there yet.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I guess just on a final note to wrap up the segment, if it does come down to a Trump-Sanders contest, certainly that would be the ultimate showdown of two very distinct varieties of angry white man. So I would welcome that. Well, we'll see what happens tomorrow in Iowa. Okay, and we're back at the Affairs Current, so I'm going to throw to Declan to introduce this second segment.
So the topic that I want to discuss today, as written in the New Statesman, is the topic of the gig economy and its impact on workers' rights, sort of the specter of digitalized labor exchange, how it sort of has basically revolutionized the marketplace in the way that employers have retreated to a sort of new legal and social realm of being independent applications in which, you know, workers have to subject themselves to in order to pursue, you know, meeting supply and demand of labor. But, you know, the sort of employer has kind of obfuscated their responsibilities, and as well as the response of labor, policymakers, and business to this sort of new world of work. As well, just from the perspective that I personally have, is that, you know, to reduce it to a left-right continuum is to really ignore the real questions of why we work in a society, of why the economy is there to function. And I think our connection to work itself is an important question. That's not just, well, you know, these employers are right-wingers who are, you know, escaping their responsibilities to employees. I think there's a question of what do employees get out of, you know, digitalized labor exchange, and what do employees, and how does, you know, flexible labor, how does creative labor, and how does self-driven labor really impact, you know, I personally, I think, you know, all those three things are very good: to have creative work, to have creative labor, self-directed. All these things are beneficial for the worker as well as the employer. So,
So I mean, I think there's a number of things you can bring up here. So the first thing, I mean, let's kind of narrow down what we're talking about here. You said gig economy, but for people who don't know, we're kind of talking about
Lyft, TaskRabbit. Those sort of they're just apps, really, but they are so much more than that, and their impact on the economy is huge.
Yeah. So that's kind of what we're talking about here. So I think there are So I think there's two levels of critique that you could make here. The first level is what are the particular business practices of these individual companies, like Uber, like things like this. Now, I'm not terribly well read about TaskRabbit or Lyft, but I do know about Uber because this has become a pretty big controversy, particularly in a number of Canadian cities. And before I start anything, I do want to say I kind of wish Miles were here for this, simply because I think he has a very different and a very useful perspective coming from a more labor organizer background on these issues. So maybe if I was to talk about this again, I would get him on here to have his perspective. But regardless, let us plow forward. So here's the thing. People make particular critiques about Uber, both its business practices as far as the surge pricing, as far as and then also its employment practices, as far as, you know, not being very much resistant to the idea of its workers collectively bargaining. It doesn't even call them workers. It says something like, oh, you're an independent contractor, whatever. Now, I think you can make very particular critiques about their particular practices of labor and the way they do those things, which I think are incredibly valid. However, where I tend to part company with some people is more in the question of, like, these apps and this sort of way of running things in general. Because I think there is a bit of a kind of phobia about technology for its own sake that comes into this discussion when you start talking about these things. Because I think, you know, let's kind of analyze what Uber, and I'm going to use Uber just as my example because it's the one I'm most familiar with, is actually doing in terms of this. Now, Uber are fundamentally, what are they, Uber cars? They are fundamentally unlicensed taxis, right? Now, unlicensed taxis have existed since people had cars and would like to make a couple of bucks on the side. Anybody who has ever been to Gatineau knows that there are, you know, outside of any of these terrible clubs that exist, there are always a series of unlicensed taxis, guys who will just come up and say, hey, do you need a ride home? You know, it's going to be such and such amount. Okay, fine. I've taken them. Now, was that a smart decision for me to do that and potentially not, potentially wake up in a bathtub missing my kidneys? No, that was probably not the best decision I could have made. So there is a real safety concern there, although, of course, you know, Uber would point out that it does do background checks on its drivers. But, of course, there have been incidents where that was not really, let's say, properly done. But anyway, so just to say that I don't see the actual exchange of what's going on here as fundamentally different from the unlicensed taxi, let's call it, market. In the case of Uber. Now, what is different is you have the company in there as the middleman. And that classic unlicensed taxi case, I just pay that guy $25 and he pockets it, right? You have this middleman in the middle, and I think that's where the real problem is. I would like to see if, and I think this was in a Jacobin article once, if there is a potential for these sorts of companies, quote unquote, to be organized in a more cooperative fashion so that you would not have this person in the middle taking this big chunk out of it. Now, the other question that kind of comes into this is, and I just, on a matter of principle, I have a real problem as a person who broadly identifies as progressive or left with, in the case of the taxi market, defending what is essentially a government-guaranteed oligopoly over the ability to provide taxi services. I don't think that's something that left-wing people ought to be defending, these sort of rent-seeking practices. So I think there's a lot to discuss as far as what the particular practices of Uber are versus, okay, how can we harness these sorts of technological innovations in a really productive way? Because I think, like, ultimately what it comes down to is that the wages that Uber drivers earn tend to be quite a bit less than taxi drivers, unionized taxi drivers. So, like, why is that? Well, for one thing, it's for that middleman taking the cutout. Uber also tends to be cheaper for riders. You could say, okay, it's cheaper for riders. So how does that shake out in terms of the economic calculus? But all that just to say, I think that, and what is very good in the article that I'm going to link to, is perhaps we need to get out of this model where so many benefits, particularly in the United States, where you have healthcare benefits that are delivered through your employer, but even in Canada as well, other things like addition, like supplementary healthcare benefits, like pensions, all those kind of things, are linked to work. They're linked to an employer. Maybe we need to, if there's going to be more flexibility in the labor market moving forward, and a lot of this is a question about resource mobilization, because otherwise the Uber cars would just be sitting in people's driveways. It wouldn't really be doing anything productive. And people want to earn a couple bucks on the side. So because of all of that, maybe we need to start thinking about, instead of trying to reassert an older model of, you know, collective bargaining and getting extracting concessions from employers that way, maybe we need to start thinking about this in a more fundamentally political kind of way, which is to say that these protections and things like that should be delivered through a universal government-based approach, which ultimately, I mean, and I would say this because I'm a big advocate for it, ultimately that comes back to the idea of a basic income and then also these other kind of floors and protections. Now, I've just said a lot of things there, so I'll let you respond.
I mean, I think you strike on a lot of really insightful parts. I think the question of unions and just the collective bargaining and extraction of gains for workers, it's a 19th, 20th century model. It's a 19th, 20th century vehicle. We're entering the 21st century with flexible labor. There has to be a different response. And the idea of a flexible sort of universal programs is definitely a policy response that is appropriate when there isn't someone who aspires to work at the same company and get the company watch after 25 years. That sort of model of work is very much non-existent, especially in the millennial mind. So, I mean, flexible labor is a definite policy problem that has to be tackled with. And actually connecting to a new development was there a petition signed by multiple union leaders, as well as the CEOs and founders of Lyft, regarding this, regarding the idea of flexible labor and how there needs to be a policy response. They even wanted to create a new position of independent contractor for legal protections to apply to. And this is a declaration signed by, you know, these leading lights of both the labor movement and the gig economy movement, as well as Seattle, though. It shows an example that it can be drifted back into the union thing, because Seattle has, you know, ruled that, or the city council has passed ordinances saying that union or labor or Uber drivers can unionize so that they can, you know, pursue their labor means through that avenue. I think as well, you strike on something really interesting here. I'll go back. I just want to say one more thing on it. I think there's a sort of Luddite reaction to it, in the way that creative destruction has always created anxiety for workers, and that the left has typically tried to provide a response to anxious workers about the economy. But I think it's we can't get stuck in a sort of romanticism of primitivism. We can't be excited by non-advancement. We need to be excited about progress and moving towards something better, rather than just trying to save the positions of those who are affected by the new developments.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the biggest thing it comes back to me is, like, I think, you know, when we talk about the unions movement and we talk about the kind of gains that were made for workers in those kinds of jobs, what were they, right? They were very sort of mechanical, rote, kind of activity-based jobs, industrial labor, things like that. Now, a lot of the reason that has not continued is because of outsourcing. Some of it is that. And of course, I think where I do fall more on, let's say, the traditional leftist side of this argument is about the fact that in many of the cases we're talking about, the reason that there isn't strong collective bargaining in the countries where they get outsourced to is because they're run by authoritarian or otherwise very corrupt sorts of governments who ally with employers to not allow people to unionize. So that's obviously a problem. And I think that, you know, over the long term, there needs to be a really global perspective about what labor rights mean, so that we have a universal set of norms about collective bargaining and all that kind of thing. So I think that's one point. The other point, though, is automation. Now, I think fundamentally, we may in the future, I think we're moving towards there. I don't think we've got there quite yet. But in the future, perhaps the near future, we may get to a point where we have abundance, right? We just have basically, you know, I mean, arguably we have it now. You know, there's a lot of sort of created wants in society that having particular clothes or particular kinds of status symbols that we have to purchase. But all that just to say, like, if you look at just very basic material goods, we've probably already reached abundance as far as that goes. So at that point, once you reach the kind of like that future, what it fundamentally the question becomes more about is a distributional question. And that's where I think, does organized labor have a part to play? I think absolutely. I also think we underrate here the idea of organized labor not as strictly a means of getting economic extractions, but more as a means of representation in a workplace. If you're being harassed by a manager, if somebody is violating occupational health and safety, all that kind of thing. So I think that's another function that they perform that is very important and very underrated. But just to say that if we're going to have, you know, less work to do, and if work is going to be more flexible for a variety of reasons, then we have to start thinking, okay, as far as the distributional angle, it needs to be more state-directed, it needs to be more flexible, and again, I think it comes back to a basic income, I think it comes back to those sorts of universal protections. And I think the other thing that is really important to keep in mind here is that, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned about the unions that did sign on to this were SEIU, who traditionally represents, you know, precarious and low-wage workers in general, so it's interesting that they are the ones that are really on board with this idea of, okay, we need to move towards a more universal set of protections. Maybe we need to create new categories of workers with particular rights to recognize what we're doing. Because, I mean, in any kind of regulatory situation, there's always going to be innovation, and then the regulation has to catch up with it. So they're kind of saying, okay, because these new things have happened, we really need a new category of worker to be able to recognize and give them, you know, particular rights at work, and to understand, you know, what the future of that economy is going to look like.
Yeah, I think we strike on a sort of paranoia of regulation that I think both policymakers and people who rely on, you know, regulation as a measure of achieving what they're looking for, it's definitely, there's sort of a paranoia that they won't be able to regulate once this gig economy gets up and started. Yeah, I mean, there is a systematic attack on labor. We can't ignore that. You know, they, from outsourcing to, you know, making it hard to collectively bargain and unionize, it's a systemic attack. I mean, if the ILO or the International Labor Organization was as big as the IMF, you know, maybe there'd be a balance thing. But, you know, you never hear about the ILO because they don't. The role that is, while important, is not nearly as big as, you know, international finance. Yeah, and I think you strike on two points that I really like, is the idea of abundance. And, you know, we are mechanizing as a society, we're not just outsourcing, but automation. And when we first automated labor, there was still plenty of jobs to go around, you know, doing the processes around the automation. But as well, once we start mechanizing mental processes, it becomes a sort of issue of, well, what is the value add of humans doing the process? Well, there is certainly going to be, and I don't wish to make the case that, you know, we have ended labor, because that is both ambitious and a bit naive at this point, at least. You know, we're starting to see entire industries becoming entirely in jeopardy of being wiped out, and that wouldn't need to be replaced. A computer could, and computer processes can basically do the job. I think of real estate as one of the other ones, is that you don't really need a real estate agent anymore. You could probably run it through an application, and most people do. They independently run this process. So I think we have hit a point of abundance, and the capitalist system seems, you know, obviously unprepared for it, because it requires a sort of competitive labor force that is, you know, striving to fill jobs. And if we're filling those jobs with people that aren't, if we fill jobs with processes that don't create income, how do we then push income to consumers to then buy in the marketplace to drive the whole system?
I mean, this is a very important point to hit on. And there was actually a book that was recently released by Paul Mason, who is a journalist for Channel 4 in the United Kingdom, called Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. And he kind of makes the basic argument that you're kind of making there, which is the idea of, you know, fundamentally this breaks the sort of wage-price structure of capitalism when you have so much of the labor market that is based on information, that is based on applications, that no longer generate income in the traditional way that people view these things. Because a lot of, like, for one thing, you know, if you, like, let's take the idea of information as a good, right? If I write a column, if that's my job, I'm a columnist, I write things for a living. The thing is, everybody on the internet can view my column, right? If one person views my column, another person can view the exact same column. It doesn't affect that at all, right? And let's take this analogy further. If I generate information, so much of the economy now is based on the generation of information. But information, unlike goods, capital goods, physical goods, is infinitely reusable and infinitely replicatable, right? That breaks all kinds of things that are fundamental to a normal analysis of how capitalism performs. Because unlike information, you know, if I buy a car, you can't. Well, I mean, I guess you can borrow my car, but like the car breaks down over time. I own the car, like all these other sorts of things. So just to say that I think. I really think that what needs to happen here is a more wide conceptualization about what we view as particular social protection, what we view these things as being. And look, I don't think this is going to be easy, because the fundamental thing is, so much of the reason that so much income has gone to top earners since the 1970s has been because of these processes of automation. It's gone disproportionately to the people who own the companies, because they've been able to automate things such that the people who, you know, ordinarily would have worked those jobs don't have into that anymore. And then there's also a kind of smaller layer of like the top 10% that has gained a bit in income, because they're the people who know how to run those automated processes, basically. Or they have like jobs in analysis or like trend perception or things like that, where you're not so much working with your hands, you're working with, you know, your thought processes. But as you put it, you know, if you can start automating those more mental tasks, which is going on more and more, or at least outsourcing them in this kind of weird way where, for example, you use the example of the real estate agent. Yeah, it is true. People now just want to put their house listing online and sell it. They don't want to go through a real estate agent anymore. So a lot of those kind of like more upper middle class kind of jobs where you really did have to have people skills and things like that, even those are kind of being automated or outsourced in a way that they weren't before, because I think people desire a flexibility. For another thing, they probably, in the case of the real estate agent, they probably won't want to pay the agent fee. So all that kind of to say, in a weird way, this kind of touches back on the same thing that we were talking about before, is that the decline of the legitimacy of institutions, in the sense of people no longer feel real loyalty to the companies that they work for. You use that example about, you know, the guy who works at General Motors or whatever for 45 years and then you get a gold watch and you retire. You know, I mean, some people say that the reason that this declined is, you know, because of all these changes in the economic order. I think that's part of it. And you can ask a very interesting kind of chicken and egg question about which came first. Did people's mindsets change, or did the reality of what the economy looks like change? But nevertheless, I think if you ask most people, particularly of our generation, do you want to work at the same company for 45 years? Most people will say, no, I'd like to do different things with my time. I'd like to. So, and that's fine, but the fundamental thing is, you know, we need to just have a certain minimum of social protection in order to make sure that while these processes of automation, of efficiency gains are going on, the gains are not so lopsidedly distributed.
Yeah, I mean, I think working people need a new vehicle to express their interests in the same way that unions did in the past. I mean, there is, with the decline of unions, there's no vehicle to match capital's sort of.
I mean, I think you do see.
Strength in the arena.
I think you do see the start of that in things like some of the projects SEIU has been involved with. The Fight for 15 campaign is a very good example of, let's say, non-traditional labor organizing that is going on. So I think you are starting to see the seeds of a new response in those sorts of movements.
I'm personally hoping for a more cooperative companies that, you know, kind of, rather than the stark division between employer and employee, we can sort of meld them so that, you know, the gains of wealth kind of, and the gains of productivity of our economies are more fairly distributed. There's no need for an individual to own the information behind something when all the employees do the work generating the value. Those are my personal beliefs, obviously much contested personal beliefs. But yeah, I don't want to make the case that post-capitalism and the gravedigger thesis is about upon us, and that capitalism has finally sown the seeds of its own destruction. I don't want to go that far.
Well, I mean, I don't think, like, in the case of Paul Mason, it wasn't really a traditional, even though he draws on some Marxist sources, it wasn't really a traditional Marxist argument. He was sort of more arguing that, like, an information-based economy really only is able to fit within that kind of capitalist model because of the idea of intellectual property. And more, that's kind of being eroded through these various means. So, and I mean, yeah, I mean, I think what needs to kind of happen, and I think you touched on it, is that, you know, I think just some of these tech startups and things like that, you know, frankly, maybe, you know, leftists need to learn how to code better. I don't know. Like, just in the sense of, like, I have my reservations about Uber because of its practices as a company. For another thing, the people running it seem kind of like jerks. But, like, yeah, off-putting. That's the word I should have used. But nevertheless, just to say, like, if there was an Uber-like thing, but it was run cooperatively in the sense of, you know, there wasn't this middleman, it would be an investment on the part of everybody, the drivers who were running cars going in and making this application so that everybody could be involved with it, they would split the profits, etc. Now, the only issue with that is it would have to be kind of localized, so you'd have to have, like, that application, but maybe you could, like, you know, kind of export it and say, okay, everybody who wants to be involved in the, you know, cooperative for, you know, this this area, you know, join the cooperative, I don't know what you would call it, that's I gotta come up with a catchy name, but, like...
districts, regions,
yeah. Well, I just mean what
cooperative.
Yeah, and then each you know, person would be involved in that particular cooperative, and then you could use an Uber-like application on your phone to order one of the taxis, or whatever you want to call them, from that cooperative, and then they would split the profits there. I think that would be like basically a blending of both the you know, importance of you know, fairly distributing the gains of these things, but then also recognizing that, you know, people want a more efficient, smooth manner of doing things. So, you know, I think that would be basically what I would like to see people really start to think about as far as this goes.
Yeah, I imagine the structure would have to be hashed out in more thought, but I think that, yeah, of course, but I imagine it'd have to stay sort of, there'd have to be a sort of corporate section of that company that would not just regionalize too much to, you know, do the process of coding. Another key point also as well is the sort of democratization of access to a sort of capital good. Because if the capital good of producing information is, say, the internet and a computer, it's interesting to see there's a sort of greater access to sort of the new factory of the 20th century, being the computer processing code. So it's kind of interesting that way. I don't mean to go to full Thomas Friedman and say, you know, the world is flat, everyone has access. But it's growing, you know, which means that more people have access to entrepreneurial startup as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's the other thing we really should point out is that, like, we are speaking very much in a North American, European context where access to the internet and to informational goods that flow from it is fairly widely distributed, not universally, but fairly widely distributed. Of course, you know, one of the I think one of the big problems actually of the world right now is the fact that is becoming a divide between who has access to the internet versus who doesn't in many countries. So I think that's the other portion of this that really deserves to be talked about is the idea of digital connectivity, as you put it, as the factory of the 21st century. We need to be able to connect people to that in order to have them both A, contribute, and B, benefit from these things. But ultimately, I think what it comes back to is just like, as far as Uber, as far as taxis and things like that go, I just, on an ideological level, I just don't believe that it's a very good idea to defend private oligopolies. If, like, we socialize the taxi system, then that's a whole different argument. Like, I'm not arguing, you know, Uber should replace mass transit systems. I'm not arguing that. But I am arguing that there's a rent-seeking aspect to this that I think people should be very aware of. And, I mean, it comes even into things besides taxis. Like, let's look at, you know, in the U.S., I don't know how much – I mean, I haven't analyzed how much of an issue this would be in Canada, but let's say in the U.S., there's a lot of things about professional licensing requirements for particular professions. Now, some of this, of course, is you have to pass an exam to you know, be able to do these things. But it's gotten outrageous in some of these states what they're saying, you know, and you have to pay a fee, of course, to take the exam and all these kind of things. And it's things like you have to, you know, do all these hours of training to become a hairdresser. And if you are caught, you know, cutting somebody's hair and, you know, paying them for somebody pays you to do that, you can be fined, or you can, you know, in some cases even go to jail for doing that, for violating that. So just to say that I think those occupational licensing requirements and things like that, which some of these gig economy services get around, is also a problem because it locks certain people, particularly lower income people, out of that market when they may like to sell particular goods, when they may like to engage in particular professional activities. You know, and I guess I just don't, again, like all this comes back to is as long as there's a floor for people that they don't fall below in terms of income, I think, and it's a good floor, like not the Ontario Works floor, you know, as long as it's a floor of, you know, reasonably above the poverty line that people don't fall below. I think the increased flexibility is fine. But again, I think it's all more about just generating the political will and frankly the conscious recognition, because I think we have a very, very tightly wound together, even people on the left, you'll see this come up, with issues around, for example, people in America who are more left-wing will point out, these people who are working, who are still receiving food stamps. Well, the thing is, some people would say that is in a certain way a kind of success in the sense of, okay, this government program that's universally delivered is delivering these benefits to people. But then you also get this argument of, well, anybody who's working shouldn't be in poverty. So what does that ultimately mean? It's kind of we've wound together the idea of like having the ability to live with work. In this very interesting way that, you can go back to Max Weber, you can go back to all these kind of things. And I think really what maybe needs to happen in the 21st century more than anything else is we need to just start breaking down that very tightly wound thing through something like a basic income. But then, if people want to gig on the side with Uber, that's fine. If people want to, do other particular pursuits, that's fine. But we just need to find a way of guaranteeing that everybody gets a decent standard of living out of that whole arrangement.
Yeah, just going back to what you said at the beginning, yeah, the connectivity divide is something that policymakers are definitely going to have to deal with, almost from a development perspective. In the fact, if you look at relative poverty, in a way, the connectivity thing is not being connected is a sign of sort of relative poverty. And it's gone a long way since Adam Smith first defined relative poverty as, every British man having a white shirt, while, people across the world don't even have the white shirt. The white shirt symbolizes, getting out of the poverty, or at least even the poor should have a white shirt, even though, the poor in the other parts of the world, would love to have just even the white shirt. Still having the white shirt is a sign of poverty. But then it's interesting that you mentioned the U.S. Trade associations, or I guess, or self-licensing associations, is that they're almost reminiscent of artisan guilds of prior centuries in which they would self-regulate and self-police to their own benefit.
Well, except that they're not self-regulating and self-policing. They're using the state to do these things. But yeah,
definitely integrate with state support. But just there is a parallel there that kind of struck me that was kind of interesting. Decoupling the cultural meme of work, providing enough to live so that people don't have to be on welfare and work is definitely something that is going to be a next thing to tackle. But I'm not quite sure that we can tackle the idea of, I think that what it comes down to is you have to provide a benefit to society before society wants to provide a benefit back to you. It's almost sort of like, are you qualified to draw from our societal resources? And maybe that's a question of scarcity. Maybe we'll have to solve scarcity before we can allow people to draw.
If you don't mind, I want to kind of wrap up here. I think what you said there is fundamentally the reason we as a society, at least under a capitalist sort of model, made that very tight connection between work and having income is because of that scarcity question, you have to generate value so that we give something back to you, that kind of thing. But like I say, we may in the future enter a sphere where there is abundance. And if we enter that, I think this question becomes a lot more urgent. I think it becomes a lot more politically feasible to make the argument that, like, look, I mean, this is the meme that exists around people who do receive welfare right now, is all of these people just sitting around not doing anything, blah, 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 blah. Maybe instead of, like, making the argument that, people want to work and all that kind of thing, maybe, we, as the left, as progressives, need to start making the argument that, it doesn't matter. They still are entitled to a decent standard of living. Everybody's entitled to a decent standard of living. And as a society, through technological progress, we've generated enough to be able to do that. So I think, if nothing else, I think this has been a very interesting discussion. Again, I kind of wish Miles was here. He has a bit different perspective on this whole thing. But with that, I think we'll move on to recommended readings. Okay, and now we're back for our final segment, recommended readings. So I will let Declan go first on that.
Yeah, so my article going on with the establishment response to outsider left-wing candidates is Should Labor Split by the New Statesman. It's basically a collection of interviews with the leading lights of the Labour Party in the UK about whether Labour should split along its, you know, left-wing axis, mirroring sort of the Limehouse Declaration 35 years ago when a bunch of Labour MPs did split and started the Social Democratic Party, which basically consigned the UK to Conservative dominance for over a decade.
Okay, so I guess I think the interesting thing about that article particularly is that they got all these different Labour people who are on various wings of the party to comment, and they all basically said no, Labour should not split. And the main reason they came up with that thing was because of this issue with the Social Democratic Party in the 80s, which, yeah, as you say, like largely contributed to these continued Thatcher victories. And I guess just to make one final point, I think there's always been a tension in the Labour Party that goes back to basically post-1945 anyway, goes back to that whole divide between the Democratic Socialists and the Social Democrats, which I think you're really seeing come up now because, I mean, there's only ever been arguably two situations where a Democratic Socialist as opposed to a Social Democrat has led the party, right now with Corbyn and then arguably Michael Foot in the early 80s, although that's questionable at that point in the party anyway. But anyway, it's a very interesting article for all the opinions they got. You got your Neil Kinnock in there, you got everybody, so Roy Hattersley, everybody.
I do want to just chime in and say there are some people who think that the party should split near the bottom. But just that they're much less leading lights. They're much more Blairite advisors.
Everybody, I should say, okay, yes. I think it was Frank Field, and there was like one other guy who said, and I mean, okay, I should. Well, we need to rephrase. Everybody important who is quoted in that article
exactly.
Says, take that, Frank Field. Anyway, so my recommended reading is not so much a recommended reading as a recommended video that you can watch. So there's this project that the New York Times has been engaged in for, I think, over 2 years now called Retro Report, which is basically a series of videos about big news stories from, you know, previous decades and kind of like what the news coverage was at the time, but updating it to say, okay, like what actually happened or like what came of this and that kind of thing. So what they've done this time is, and I, as somebody who takes a particular interest in the idea of, you know, military spending, all that kind of thing, it's basically a piece from Retro Report about the F-35 fighter jet, and just the incredible saga of the procurement around this thing that has gone on for over 15 years. It goes back even further now, and basically doesn't really seem to have any particular end in sight. And I guess I just liked it because it was a real demonstration of that whole idea of just bureaucracy, just, you know, political favors being doled out, and military procurement not so much as a question of really efficiency or what you actually need to, you know, do what you want to do militarily. And, you know, I think we know a lot about this for various vectors in Canada, but more for political reasons and more for just the kind of idea of, okay, we want to show off this really nice, expensive hardware. So anyway, Retro Report, and the video is called Runaway Jet. So I think with that, we'll close up shop for this episode. It's been a very enlightening discussion, very interesting discussion. Do you have anything final that you'd like to add, Declan?
Just thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure having such, you know, stimulating conversations with you and talking about such matters of such weight. You know, if you liked anything that I said today, which, you know, hopefully I said a few things that you liked, you can follow me on Twitter. I believe it's on the podcast page, sir_d_ingham. Or you can check out a few of my articles on thewesterner.com or thewesterner, double E.
There's two E's in The Westerner. I've never actually gone to, if you don't put the second E, what comes up. So maybe tell me, listeners, write in, what happens when you go to the Westerner as opposed to The Westerner? Anyway, so with that, we'll close up. Our email, as always, theaffairscurrent@gmail.com, blog, theaffairscurrent.blogspot.com, Facebook, Twitter, all that. Follow us on there. And with all that, for myself and for Declan, I wish you a pleasant week.